So we're just having a discussion with some spirits about the concept of God providing myself, Jesus, as a sacrifice to the world in order for the world to be saved. And what we're going to do first is just read to our spirit friends a message. A message from John via James Paget in 1916, which sort of discusses the logic of such a belief system. And then we'll talk to our spirit friends about, you know, with and answer their questions that they may have about the particular presentation. But it's best for them to listen first to the entire message and then to discuss and ask questions about the message itself. So this is the 18th of March 1916, where John discusses the belief in the efficacy of the vicarious atonement of Jesus by his death and crucifixion by the churches has caused much harm to mankind and the loss of the true way to the celestial kingdom. So here the message starts. I am here, John, the apostle of Jesus. I wish to write tonight on a subject that is of importance to the members of the Orthodox churches, as to the belief in the efficacy of the atonement of Jesus by his death and crucifixion. All the Orthodox believe, and their preachers and evangelists teach in their sermons and addresses, and the teachers of the Bible classes instruct their students, that the blood of Jesus and his death on the cross were the two factors in his career on earth that save men from their sins and satisfy the great penalty of death which overhangs them, because of man's first disobedience and the sins that followed therefrom. Well, this doctrine has prevailed in the beliefs and teachings of the Church ever since the Church became established by the convention that met in pursuance of the orders of Constantine, when the books that now constitute the Bible were given the sanction of the Church as canonical. Before this time, some of the early fathers believed in the doctrine of the atonement as stated above, and the controversies between them and others who did not subscribe to this doctrine were very bitter, and at times very unchristian, according to the Christianity that prevailed among the early followers of the Master, or according to his teachings. From that time until the present, although the great Roman Church has been seceded from and reforms have been made by churches founded on such reforms, this doctrine has been incorporated in and believed by most of the churches, no matter what name they may have adopted and what form of government they may have prescribed. This doctrine constitutes the foundation principles of these various bodies of church entity, and today these principles are as much of a part of faith and teachings of the churches as they ever were in all the centuries that have passed. Of course, with this cardinal doctrine, there have also become incorporated in these faiths and teachings certain other principles, which apply more to the individual members of the church than to the church itself as a body. I mean, belief in the truth that there is a close relationship between God and the individual, which may be established by prayer and the longings of the soul for the inflowing of God's love, and the regeneration of the nature of man by the influence of this love by the Father. But in these latter days, this truth has been known to and its workings experienced by a comparatively few of those who call themselves Orthodox Christians. The large majority has depended upon the belief in the doctrine that Jesus, by his sacrifice and death, paid the debt which man owed to God. And when the members of the church in an intellectual belief assert that they believe in and accept Jesus as their saviour because he paid the debt and by the shedding of his blood washed away their sins and made them at one with the Father and thereby became saved from the wrath of the Father and in a moment became the truly redeemed and accepted children of God, and that as long as they maintain that belief and attend to their duties as such, members, and observe the regulations of the church, they are safe and fitted for enjoyment of heaven and the presence of the Father. They also believe that unless a man accepts Jesus as his Saviour, in the way I have mentioned, that man will be eternally lost, and in the beliefs and teachings of some of these members will be sent to hell to be eternally damned and punished. Well, one view of this doctrine is just as true as the other, or rather, just as untrue, because both of these phases of belief have no foundation in fact and are not in accord with the teachings of the Master or with the fact as I know it to be, not from any mere belief but from personal experience and observation. Oh, how the pure teachings of the Master have been distorted and made the means of preventing so many human souls from reaching the heaven of happiness that they wished for and that they thought would be theirs when they should give up their mortal lives. This doctrine, so long believed, has worked the damnation of many a man as regards his soul development and his becoming at one with the Father and reaching the heavens that are prepared for those who obtain that soul union with the Father. I know it may seem surprising to some who are really true believers in this doctrine and, as they think, in the truths of God and the teachings of Jesus, which are believed to be infallibly contained in the Bible, that I announce the falsity of these beliefs and their utter ineffectiveness in enabling these sincere people to obtain that which they so earnestly desire. But such is truth, and truth never changes, never compromises with untruth, and never permits the erroneous beliefs of a really sincere mortal to swerve in one iota from the results and consequences of that false belief. And the great injury that this false doctrine has done to humanity and is now doing will continue in the world to come until the belief in truth shall supersede the belief that which is false. And thus not everyone who shall say, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom of heaven. These false beliefs have operated in two ways to injure man and render him unfit for an entrance into the kingdom. First, by the belief that brings about the injury that results from the positive operation of error, which is great. And next, by the want of belief in the truth, which prevents progress in the acquirement of those qualities which belong to and are necessary parts of that truth. When men believe in the doctrine that I have stated, they become satisfied and, knowingly or not, remain in a state of false security, not attempting to develop the soul qualities, which are the only ones that are in relationship with God. Their mental beliefs are strong and may increase in strength, but their soul communions with the Father and their growth and expansion in the soul development become stagnant and, as it were, dead. This is the great injury that these false beliefs do to the man and to the spirit. I mean in his individual capacity, for it must be known as a truth, that the salvation of man or his soul progress towards atonement with the Father is an individual matter solely, and men as aggregations or in church communities are not redeemed from sin, nor as such can they have any relationship with the Father or receive his divine love, which is the only salvation. There is only one possible way in which man can come into unison and atonement with the Father, and thereby fitted to enjoy or inhabit the mansions in his kingdom, which Jesus spoke of when on earth. And that is the way that will make the soul of man like the soul of the Father and a partaker of his divine qualities of love and life. No belief that will not bring about this uniting and commingling, as it were, can possibly make the soul of man a partaker of these qualities that are a part of the soul of God. Then let man consider for a moment what possible connection there can be between these soul qualities of God and the death and blood of Jesus. God is the creator of life and death, and also of blood and flesh, and he can destroy as well as create. Had the sins of man called for the sacrifice of that which was mere flesh and blood, or the extinguishment of a life that God had created in order to pay the penalty of that sin, then a God who demanded such a payment, and this implies, of course, that such a God was wrathful and could only be appeased by something that he could not of and by himself obtain, would not possibly be satisfied with that which he had created and over which he still had absolute control and which he could destroy and make non-existent at any time he pleased. Jesus' life was already a possession of God, and when he surrendered that life, he did not give to God anything that he did not already own and could not have taken. And when his blood, Jesus' blood, flowed on the cross, it was not that which God could have not made flow at any time and in any manner. So the absurdity of such a doctrine is too apparent for serious consideration. For its logical meaning is that God was demanding a debt that had long been unpaid, all wrathful, God was all wrathful and insatiable, and would be satisfied only with the death of a living being and the flowing of his blood, and that death and that flow of blood in one way or manner only, namely on the cross. And yet, with all this demand that has been sounding down the ages for centuries, relentlessly, unpityingly, he became satisfied and his wrath assuaged by seeing his own creature die, and that creature his best beloved son, and by hearing the trickling of the blood of that creature from a wooden cross, by all which the life and the blood already being his, to let live or destroy as he might see fit, man became at one with him. The simple reduction of such a proposition is that God, in order to pay a debt that was owing to him, accepted in payment thereof that which was already his, and which no power or being in all his universe could have taken away from him anyway. Now, I say all this reverently, as your preachers say, but the fact is that the mere assertion of such a doctrine as I have been dealing with is so blasphemous that no treatment of it showing its falsity could be irreverent. And again, the absurdity of believing that God demanded that Jesus should die on the cross as one of the necessary accompaniments of his death, in order to carry out God's plan for his death and make the payment satisfactory, is so apparent and absurd that I and all of us spirits in the kingdom of the Father wonder that mortals can believe such an unreasonable dogma. To follow this absurd proposition to its logical conclusion, it was necessary not only, in order that the debt might be paid, that Jesus should die on the cross, but that Judas should become the traitor, that the Jews should clamour for his death, and that Pilate should pronounce the sentence. These were all necessary means to the satisfaction of the debt, and being so, why is it then that Judas and Pilate and the Jews are not saviours of mankind also, even if you say in a secondary sense? Jesus could not have clamoured for his own death, or erected his own cross, or nailed himself thereto, or pierced his side with a spear in order that the blood might flow, for if he had done this, he would have been a suicide. But it may be there would have been more of the elements of the payment of a debt in that method of dying than in the way in which his death was brought about. No, I tell you, I, John, who loved the Master more than all the others and who was closer to him, who was with him when he was nailed to the cruel cross, which I think of with horror, and who was among the first to take his body from the tree and first felt his blood upon my hands, tell you that the death of Jesus on the cross did not pay any debt that man owed to God, nor did his blood wash away the sins of any man. And oh, the pity of it all is that mortals for all of these long years have believed that they were saved by his sacrifice and blood, and by such belief have never come any nearer to the Master or in atonement with the Father. As I and others have written you, the only way in which a man can be saved from his sins and become in atonement with the Father is by the new birth, which the Master has described to you as being the result of the flowing into the soul of a man of the divine love of the Father, and the disappearing of everything that tends to sin and error. This love flows into a man's soul, it permeates the soul as it does leaven the batch of dough. And that soul partakes of this divine love and thereby becomes like the Father in his divine nature and fitted to inhabit his kingdom. Now, you can readily see that there can be no possible relationship existing between the death of Jesus on the cross and his blood and the giving to the soul of man those divine qualities that belong to the Father's nature. These qualities are not imparted to any man by death and blood, but by life and love and faith which comes with that love. And here, when I say faith, I do not mean the mere intellectual belief of which I have spoken. As we have before written, when the first parents were created, they were not given this divine love, but the mere possibility of obtaining it upon their seeking for it in the way that God provided. It was not forced upon them, but it was optional with them, whether they would receive it and become fitted to inhabit the kingdom of heaven. When they committed their act of disobedience, they forfeited this privilege and, as to it, died and were left without a mediator between themselves and God. And here I don't mean any mediator in the way of paying a debt, for they owed no debt to God. They were merely, as you mortals might say, disinherited children. And the only mediator that man needed after that time was one through whom God might come the glorious tidings that the Father had changed his will or forgiven the disobedience to the extent of restoring his original state, which is the rebestowal of the privilege of obtaining into their souls his divine love. And in this sense, never was there any mediator between God and man until the coming of Jesus and his announcing to man that the Father had changed his will and had restored to mankind the great privilege of partaking of his divine nature and immortality. And thus, as in the first man Adam all men died, so in the man Jesus all men were made alive. And Jesus was the mediator not only in declaring to man the rebestowal of this great gift of the divine love and immortality, but also in showing the way by which men could and must seek for that gift in order to possess it. The great gift of God to man was not Jesus, but the potential of obtaining the divine love of the Father, and thus becoming divine and fitted to reside in the mansions of the kingdom of heaven. And thus Jesus became the resurrection and the life and brought immortality to light. How much greater a saviour than by paying a supposed debt by his death and blood? No, he is the saviour of man by his living and his teachings, for he was the first to receive this divine love and to become divine himself, and the first fruit of the resurrection. We have explained to you before in detail some of the truths that I have declared in this message, and it is not necessary to further explain them here. In closing, I wish to declare with all the emphasis that I possess, arising from a knowledge based on the teachings of the Master and my personal experience as a possessor of this divine love and a partaker of the Father's divine nature, that no vicarious atonement of Jesus, nor the shedding of his blood, saves any man from sin or makes him a redeemed child of the Father or fits him for a home in the mansions of the celestial spheres. With a love that can only come from a redeemed and divine nature, I love all mankind, and I am working to help them find a way to life and immortality and happiness beyond the conception of mortals or spirits who have not received this new birth of the divine love of the Father. I have written enough for tonight, and you are tired. So, my dear brother, with all my love and blessings of a heart filled with the love of the Father, I am your brother in Christ, John. So that's the logic, I suppose, or the presentation of the illogic of the lack of logic in the saving of, that my blood, Jesus' blood, saves. Have they got any questions about that?
There was a number of things that they brought up as it went along, and there's a number of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of... perhaps if I just let them introduce themselves a bit,
sure.
And then we'll just see if they can just ask what they want to ask. Sort of, they're calling themselves the council.
Mm-hmm.
They've formed a council to have this inquiry with you.
Yep.
We are three men and two women who have decided to act as spokespeople to investigate this matter with you.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Cecil. With me is George and Marcus. And the women are Susan and Helen. Helen was present during your discussion with the group of Christians.
Yes.
Last week.
Yes. Yep.
I personally was not amongst this group,
mm-hmm.
but Marcus was also.
Right.
We represent a very large number. Some 200,000 of us are gathered here to seek to understand what it is you have been describing.
Mm-hmm.
We must say that it is difficult for us to understand the concepts that you put forward. However, we do wish to resolve this matter. We do wish to understand. And that is why we have tried to form some level of organisation
mm-hmm.
in order to ask you our questions.
Sure. May I ask you a few questions about your current situation?
Certainly.
Did you find or have you found that the expectations you had when or before you passed from the earth to the spirit world have since been realised since you're in the spirit world?
No. Mm. No, the 80% of us expected to pass into the spirit world and be greeted by Jesus, to have some kind of situation where we could understand him seated beside God and to experience a blissful paradise, a pleasure,
mm-hmm.
streets of gold.
Similar to what was described in the book of Revelation.
Yes, mm. yes. This did not come to pass.
Mm.
And while the majority of us did not find ourselves to be in a terrible place,
mm-hmm.
we understand that there are some who find themselves in this condition.
Mm-hmm.
And nor did we find ourselves to be in a particularly happy or wonderful place.
Mm.
Our lives were similar to that on earth. For some of us, worse.
Mm-hmm.
Our surroundings were worse and our level of comfort was less.
Mm-hmm.
For some of us, it was on a par.
Mm-hmm.
We were not extremely happy or overwhelmed by God. Or
mm-hmm.
For myself personally, Cecil, passing was a strange occurrence in that I found very little about my spiritual, emotional and physical condition changed.
Mm-hmm.
I found I died as a man in his 70s, early 70s, and I had some pains and aches at that time. I lived alone. My wife had passed some years previous, and I had my own home. I was comfortable, not extremely happy.
Mm-hmm.
I attended church regularly, and it was a large part of my life, mm. my church life.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that I had led a reasonably honest and moral life, and while I suffered some loneliness, a lack of passion or interest in my life at the time of my passing, I expected that after I passed that things would greatly improve.
Mm.
This did not occur for me. Mm. In fact, as I mentioned, I found myself in a very similar situation.
Mm-hmm.
It was perhaps a little darker surrounding me
mm-hmm.
in my new home, seemed a little more dark, not black or dirty, but just dimmer.
Just a little more oppressive.
Yes. Mm. I found I felt some pain and some discontent,
mm-hmm.
but I also did not
meet the people that you expected to meet.
No. I met my wife briefly, but she did not stay with me, and
mm-hmm.
I was surprised even that this did not cause me as much distress as I would have thought.
Right.
In fact, I find most of my feelings are dampened down here.
Yeah.
I don't feel much. But I have not lost faith in God.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
And this is why we have questions. Mm. We have observed in recent times your discussions surrounding sacrifice and Christianity upon the earth. And
mm-hmm.
and not myself, but some here, there were some here who were quite insistent around about having you answer this question about sacrifice.
Mm.
Certainly, for myself, it is something that I have believed in, and I do believe that Jesus died for our sins. This is the basis of my belief, And while there is some mixed feeling amongst us surrounding your identity, and I cannot deny that I suspect that you may be Jesus, this poses a great many questions for us. And
can I firstly present one logical thought to you?
Yes.
If while you're on earth you believe that the blood of Jesus' sacrifice saved you, now that you've passed into the spirit world, it's quite obvious that the blood of Jesus' sacrifice did not save you in the manner in which you imagined. Because if it had have, you would have had the expectations that you were expected as well come to you. Can you see that?
Yes. Yep. We understand this, but equally, if I speak for myself and many gathered here, I did not find myself in fiery torment.
No, I did not.
I just found, as I said, that nothing much had changed.
So the feeling that you currently have is it sort of saved you from fiery torment, if there is such a thing.
Yes, many of us have this feeling that, well, we're not in hell, bad things are not happening to us, and we can see there is goodness in what we have believed. But
it's not as good as what you expected either.
No.
No.
And I personally am having this problem where I cannot feel significant joy or loss particularly. Things do not seem very vibrant or...
So almost a numbing of desire.
Yes, I suppose so, yes. So we understand...
No, that's good that you gave that background. It's good for everyone who's hearing about this as well to be able to see that kind of background as well. And many of the others with you would have a similar background, I gather.
Yes, we...
Although they wouldn't have had the same personal experiences.
But some of them passed at greater ages than myself, some quite young. Some were very zealous in their church work, in their Christian life, they would like to call it, their spiritual life, while on earth. They got a deep sense of satisfaction from their participation in these spiritual-based activities. And they've found, since passing, that... Again, not a great deal has changed for them. They are able to participate somewhat vicariously in these church goings on and the spiritual life of others.
By sharing with the people who have those spiritual lives on earth?
Yes, yes. There is some talk amongst some young women here who wish to say that... Jasmine would like to say that... They understand that there should be something more, and they relate to my own feelings of a feeling of a dampening of joy and excitement. They very much enjoy assisting those on earth to continue in their spiritual pursuits and providing some inspiration. They find this easy to provide inspiration to people on earth to... transmit to them feelings and words that help them express their passion for God or inspire others towards God on earth. However, they do feel a sense, a nagging sense that something is lacking. But they also wish to say that they have not lost their faith in God. And they feel quite at peace with this idea of the sacrifice that has saved them. Obviously, we are here speaking to you, and so there is some question and conjecture about this belief that we all have, but we must say that it does not cause us any sense of distress having this belief. In fact, we find it quite logical and rational. We understand that you have raised some issues in this reading that you just spoke surrounding... God's control over the life of Jesus while on earth. However, we feel that largely the life of Jesus, who was in fact an aspect of God, a part of God in flesh, a part of God came down to be in flesh appear here on the earth.
Which is the belief that you retain.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. We speak, obviously, these things are somewhat in question,
yep.
But we will speak largely from our core belief systems.
Of course.
Yeah. So our feelings are that God allowed himself to become manifest upon the earth through Jesus, through the life of Jesus. And his life was in fact a demonstration of God's love for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And this sacrifice that Jesus made was a way of God demonstrating his deep love for all of humanity. And also, and now there is some discussion here, some of us feel that God loved Jesus as a son, and while Jesus was a part of God, it was more a father-son relationship that was in demonstration.
Mm.
And that.
So some of you now are uncertain about the belief of the Trinity, for example, the concept that a part of God came to earth, rather than it being a son of God or a child of God, just like any other child of God, in a unique relationship with God.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes. There is some discussion about which belief it is we hold. And it is true that there are some of us who are not at peace with understanding how some of us feel very strongly, myself included, that Jesus was God's son.
Mm-hmm.
But we also feel that there was divinity in the nature of Jesus, mm-hmm. and therefore he must have been a part of God.
Right. It's the therefore he must have been a part of God that I would question. There is a possibility of God giving, if you like, his divinity to people, but that doesn't automatically make them a part of God or equal to God. It just makes them a sharing in one of God's attributes or qualities. Do you see the difference? Right.
Yes, but we do not really feel that God is able. Okay, we feel that God perhaps did give some of his divinity to Jesus, mm-hmm. but this is not a gift that we can receive.
Right, you feel that it was only offered to Jesus.
Yes.
And Jesus is unique in that regard.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. And it is for this reason that what Jesus did was so significant. If we can say it in this way, we feel that inherently each of us requires the sacrifice of Jesus in order to be saved, because we are in essence flawed creatures.
Flawed sinners.
Sinful, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something we cannot alter.
And basically you're suggesting that God created flawed sinners.
Yes. Well, yes. This is our nature, yes.
Hmm.
And we feel strongly that the sacrifice that Jesus made reminds us of our deep need for him and for God. Because, and in a way, God created us in this needy relationship, so that we are sinful sinners, and the only way to be redeemed is to accept Jesus and God into our hearts. And this is why God created us sinful.
I understand. But it's almost like, if you could liken it to a human relationship. Did you have children when you were on a date with your wife?
Yes.
You imagine that you and your wife got together and you decided to create a child, but you wanted the child to have a genetic deformity. Why would you want the child to have a genetic deformity?
It is difficult. I understand the analogy you are making.
Because that's really what you're saying God did. You're saying God created mankind with a genetic deformity. And the genetic deformity was a predisposition towards sin. And God created that because God wanted a needy relationship with the child. Now, the average human couple on earth wouldn't want that. And what we're basically saying is that God wants something that seems to be even more degraded than what the average couple on earth would want.
There is much discussion here in saying that it is not fit to compare the relationship of God with ourselves, to a human couple and their children.
Can I just say though that if God does exist, and I and you both, we both believe God does, then it would make sense that that God would be better than any human person. In other words, God would be more loving than any human person.
Yes.
More powerful, more wise, more understanding, more compassionate, more every single quality that exists inside of a human, God would have more of. It would make sense.
Yeah, we cannot question this, no.
And God would also be more perfect. In other words, in fact, from Jesus' words in the Bible, Jesus suggested that God was perfect and that we had to become perfect in order to have a relationship with God. So if you look at the words in Matthew chapter 5, that's what he suggested.
Mm.
So that bearing all of that in mind, it would make sense to make a comparison with humanity at times. Because if we have a God who's similar in action to a human, then I would suggest to you that that God is not a logical suggestion to believe in a God that's similar to a human in his nature and in his expression of his attributes. For example, if a human is narcissistic, for example, self-absorbed, it would make sense that God, being perfect, is not narcissistic, not self-absorbed.
Yes.
If a human wanted worship, it would make sense that God, who is not narcissistic or self-absorbed, would not want worship or need worship of man in order to exist.
Certainly.
If a human views love as punishment, then it would make sense that God would not view love as punishment, because God would be more perfect than any human.
Right.
And more loving than any human.
Okay.
And in fact, one of the things that Jesus taught in the first century was the forgiving nature of God. And Jesus said that we need to learn to forgive 77 times, 7 perhaps even, more than we do. So if humans have to forgive that amount of times, then it would make sense that God would be able to infinitely forgive.
Can we say that our strong feeling here, mm-hmm, is that we do not doubt the character of God. We merely feel that if we were not created needy for God,
mm-hmm,
then we would never reach for God.
I don't agree with that at all. I can't agree with that.
It's okay, like, could you explain?
Well, it's like saying that if we were not created needy for our partner, then we would not want our partner. It's the same.
Many people here have that belief.
I agree, but that doesn't mean it's true.
We are born needy and weak, and it is through this that we form bonds with, yes, each other and with God.
But I don't agree with that.
I see.
The way I feel is that God created us perfectly, and it's only the initial sin, if you like, of Adam and Eve, the first human couple, that caused us to become needy in our relationships and needy in our expression of worship towards God.
Before, yes, then, we would agree with that.
Before the then, the way God created them was that they were not needy for God, nor were they needy for each other, but rather they expressed love towards each other.
And you see, this is what we feel, that it was through our choices that we became sinful creatures and not through God's.
I agree with that completely. Yep. I do agree that it's humans' choices that caused human to become sinful in its nature, and therefore also needy. And when I say needy, I mean addicted to specific things. You know, addicted to certain feelings, for example, in their relationships with others. But if we're going to become perfect, and Jesus did suggest in the first century, if you don't believe on Jesus, then your Jesus in the first century did suggest that we have to become perfect just as our Heavenly Father is perfect. So that means then, if we became perfect through some process that we've yet to discuss, if we become perfect, then it would make sense then that all the neediness would be gone. And just as God loves, so too we would love. And also would suggest that God is not needy for our love. God doesn't need us to worship him. God gives us the free will to choose whether we worship or not. But God is not needy,
yes,
for our worship.
No, I don't feel that God is needy for us.
No worries. So if we view it all this way, then you can see that really, from this human perspective, we were not created imperfect, but rather perfect, and that we chose imperfection by choosing to walk away from God. And it would also make sense, therefore, that if we choose to walk towards God, we can also walk towards perfection. In other words, imperfection should not always dictate our life. That is logical, isn't it?
Yes, there is some difficulty with this. Right. Could you repeat this last?
Well, if it would make sense if we were created perfect, in the case of the first human couple, God does not make a mistake in creation. So therefore, yes. The first human couple was created perfect. God is perfect and all of his creations are perfect. So the first human couple were created perfect, and they were created with this beautiful gift that we're given, which was the gift of free will, the gift to choose, the gift to make a choice and decide about what they would like to do with their life. The first human couple chose to walk away from God. They chose to walk away from God's laws. Now, the analogy is in the book of Genesis, but rather than it being a literal thing that happened, you know, eating of the fruit, but just a refusal to live by the laws of God, particularly when it comes to the laws of love. So in that choice, mankind degraded in his condition. That's what the Bible calls the fall of humanity.
Yes.
We became imperfect as a result of that fall. We became, with this imperfection, got passed down through the generations because it was an attitude or emotion that existed within each individual. But from what Jesus taught, this process could also be reversed. In other words, mankind could work their way back into perfection with God by following a process.
Okay, there is some interest about this.
Does that make sense?
Yes, we're interested
in such a
process.
And this is what Jesus came to teach, and he taught this. And I'm saying Jesus in the third person, but I know what I talk. But I taught this in the first century to show that, well, just as man made the choice into degradation, so too man can make the choice into life, that it was a free will choice, each direction. The degradation was a free will choice, but also the choice to life is also a free will choice. And so I presented this concept before I died.
May we say how we reconcile this with our belief?
Sure.
We do feel that the choice was made with the original sin to plunge us into sin, and that we are born with this, and then that yes, we do have the choice to change, but we do this through accepting Jesus.
But can I point out to you again, logically there's some flaws, because Adam and Eve, if we could call them that, the first human couple,
yes,
they did not have a third party that needed to make the choice for them. They did not have a sacrifice that caused them to go into sin. They chose through their own exercise of their own will to go into sin.
Yes, through their nature.
Not through their nature, because their nature was perfect before that point. So it's not about their nature, it's about a choice that they made, a choice to walk away from love and to walk away from God.
But would that not be an error in our nature if we made such a choice?
If there was an error in our nature, then God would have created it. And God can't create an error in our nature because God is perfect.
Then why would something perfect choose such a terrible act?
Because it has free will. It has the ability to make a choice, even if that choice is out of harmony with the purpose in which it was originally designed.
Okay, this is cause for some discussion here as well.
So this is the gift of love, the first gift of love, if you like, that God gave us. And that was, instead of making us like robots, God gave us this free will to make us beings that had the ability to control and manoeuvre our own lives. We could choose to do so without God. God gave us that ability. We could do it with God, and God gave us that ability to make that choice.
Okay.
In giving us the ability to make that choice, God was providing a perfect gift. The perfect gift was the ability, instead of having to do everything God's way, the ability to choose how you wanted to do things, whether you wanted to do them your own way at some point in the future. And when their own way became out of harmony with love, that's when sin occurred. So sin is missing the mark of love.
Yes.
So once the sin occurred, then this sin impregnated itself upon the emotions of the first human couple. In other words, the emotions, the feelings they had drove them to have a desire to ignore love.
Yes.
And this desire, when it gives birth, when it becomes fertile, gives birth to sin. So it began with a desire initially, a thought, if you like, and then a feeling. And this feeling and thought created an emotion inside of the individuals, Adam and Eve, that caused them to sin. And then when they sinned, they took actions out of harmony with love.
I see.
When they took actions out of harmony with love, they degraded their own soul. But because they then had progeny, this emotion was impregnated, if you like, upon the soul, the feelings of the next generation.
Yes,
so this made it more difficult for the next generation to walk back to God.
Yes.
Because the next generation already had the same emotional damage, the same underlying sin, and therefore the predisposition towards following what Adam and Eve followed.
And so this went on and on
until my coming.
Yes.
But what I illustrated while I was alive, and also through my own life, was that you could reverse this process. Just as mankind chose to go down that path, so too they could walk back along that path and go up towards God.
But and this forgive happened. Us if we are wrong.
And I did this while I was alive.
But you were born without this sin.
And I can't necessarily agree with that. That is a Bible concept, I agree, but it wasn't a concept that I understood at the time. I just felt myself to be a normal person, a normal creation, if you like, a normal child, that two people had sex and created me.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually speak with my father and mother in the spirit world if you wish. I can get them to come and speak with you about my life.
We would like to just resolve this issue first, but yes.
Of course. There are many people I could introduce to you that would help you resolve this issue very rapidly, though.
We would prefer to speak with you at this time.
No worries. So now a man, Jesus, had been created, if you like, through the process of the incarnation process. Are you now aware of how the soul gets inside of the bodies?
We have
observed this.
Yes.
Okay, so you're aware that a soul attaches itself to two bodies, the spirit body and the physical body?
Yes.
And that you cannot see the soul itself, but you can see when it attaches to the bodies through the flow of the energy that goes into those bodies?
Yes.
So you're aware that mankind has a soul and has two bodies, a spirit body and a material one. And if you think about it, Paul's writings to the Corinthians and so forth, he alluded to that. That he said, just as there is a physical body, there is also a spiritual one.
Yes, yes.
So when you've noticed this particular thing occur, this is exactly the same thing that occurred with me in the first century. The difference is that I aspired to reconnect with God in a manner that no one around me had ever done before. So I desired to learn about God and God's nature. Now, everyone around me at the time believed that God was a wrathful, punishing God. That was the way of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
But I could not accept that as an underlying belief system. And I decided instead that if God existed and if God was perfect, which I imagined God to be, then it would make sense to me that God would be perfect and in love and therefore would not be wrathful or punishing.
Mm-hmm.
So I made some basic assumptions about God, that God would be better than the average human. In doing so, I decided to experiment with having a personal relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
And once I had a personal relationship with God and begun this personal relationship, I started receiving love from God. A part of God, God's love, started entering me. And I noticed that the more longing I had for love and truth, the more it entered me. And in this way I became perfected, not just perfected as a human, but also perfected as eventually into a condition of oneness with God. And that happened when I was 31 years of age and when I was baptised by John.
I see.
Now, if I could do it without dying and without relying on the death of another to do it, then I suggest to you that everybody can do it without somebody dying or relying upon the death of another to do it.
The issue that we have is we do not feel satisfied that you were not different, that you did not have this sin that everyone else carries.
Well, the best thing to do is to perhaps raise this issue with some of my friends who were in the first century, whom I can bring to you, where you can ask them about my character and nature in the first century and ask them what I was like and therefore...
No, we mean the original sin.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you mean. Well... can I suggest to you that I certainly did not have the underlying original damage in the sense that I did not have this underlying idea or concept that I was now permanently removed from God.
I see.
So when I was born, and after I began to grow, and after my ideas began to formulate and my intellect began to develop, I began to formulate the idea that mankind's limited condition was not necessarily the only possibility for me.
Yes.
Whereas all the people around me saw mankind's limited condition as the only possibility.
So there was a difference in you at birth. Yes. Could you describe this?
Well, I didn't notice the difference in me at birth because obviously I did not have a developed intellect to notice it.
No,
I only noticed it as I began to grow up and started to intellectually formulate my ideas.
But what was it? What made you different?
What seemed to have made me different is that I did not believe in the limited concept of man. I believed that God, if God existed, would have created a man with the ability to grow infinitely. And I did not believe that man was limited in any way, in his nature.
So how did this happen?
Why did I have this belief? I can't really answer that question for you because this belief came to me over a period of time as a development rather than something that was instantly given to me. Does that make sense? It's a bit like you when you grow in a certain way. So, for example, if you can remember your earth life, when was it that you first noticed that you were interested in the opposite sex? Can you see that it was sort of like a growing into? It was sort of a process that occurred.
So I'm sorry to labour this point, okay. But it is significant amongst us.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that you grew out of the original sin?
No, I am saying that as I grew, I started to see that the concept of the original sin was the thing that was inhibiting mankind's ability to grow infinitely.
Yes, and if we each have
and
this and
really...
you did not have that, then surely this sets you aside and makes the possibilities for you different. Do you understand our question?
I believe that it did make the possibilities for me different, however, mm-hmm. with one exception, and that is in my coming to understand this particular concept that mankind was no longer limited by the finite belief systems that they had, but as I now believed it, that mankind had the possibilities of infinite growth, then I could teach that to other people. And so they then could also get rid of the concept that mankind is limited and also accept that mankind was able to have infinite growth.
So you're saying that the original sin can be removed from people?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And I'm saying that I removed it from myself, right? And any other person can remove it from themselves.
Then why has it only been you who has done it?
It's not only been me that has done it. In the spirit world, there are literally hundreds of thousands and hundreds of millions, actually, of people who have done it.
I see. Okay.
And I can introduce many of them to you. But the only difference between myself and others is that nobody had actually done it on Earth. That's the only limitation.
Yes, this
and
is
one of the reasons why I have returned to Earth is I want to demonstrate to people that it is possible to be done on Earth rather than waiting to the spirit world in order to do it.
Okay.
Does that make sense? That's one of the reasons why we have returned, to demonstrate that fact.
Mm-hmm.
See, there is this concept or belief in amongst most people on earth that it is impossible for them to become perfect.
This is our belief. This is why we are asking you so insistently.
Of course.
There is some mistrust of what you're saying.
Yes. And my life proved that it was possible to become perfect on earth.
This is where we disagree. We feel that you were already in this state, and so it did not demonstrate a transition.
And I can't agree with that because it was my life and I don't believe I was already in that state. I believe the possibility of the option of that state came to me through my development, and then as I engaged this development more fully, this relationship with God more fully, and engaged receiving divine love from God as a reversal of the original thing that happened to Adam and Eve, once I started to engage that process, that's when I came to see that it was reversible.
There is some difficulty for us to understand the difference. We feel there was a difference in your state at birth. We understand that you are also saying that there's a development within you after birth,
mm-hmm.
towards understanding the condition of error in mankind. Mm-hmm. And that you then developed a relationship with God which demonstrated something.
Mm-hmm.
But there is this deep feeling amongst the majority of us that there was a difference in you at birth. We understand now that perhaps it was not that you were a part of God, but there was some special condition
mm-hmm.
at your birth
mm-hmm.
which made this your life
possible.
Yes.
Yes, I do agree with that.
Right.
I do agree that there was some
okay.
special condition. And the special condition was I was not bound. This was the only special condition that I realised as I developed, that I was not bound by the original sin, if you were, or I was not bound by the limited concept that mankind was permanently assigned to this state of imperfection.
Yes, and
can I point out to you, though, that many men in the spirit world had come to that conclusion before I had. Ones like Moses and Elijah and many others had all come to that same concept before I actually arrived on the earth.
But this...
But there was nobody who had arrived on earth with the concept. Does that make sense?
Yes. How then, this is what we feel the gift is. We do feel rather stuck around this idea that your life was a gift
mm-hmm.
to each of us who we are bound by sin at birth.
Mm-hmm.
And
I agree, it is a gift. My life was a gift. But it was because of my choice that it became such.
Yes, we're not... We realise you made many choices in order to give gifts
yes.
in your life.
So I don't disagree that my life was not a gift. But it was a gift in many ways, and one of the primary ways was that I could teach another person how to have a stretched view of the human soul in comparison to what they had prior.
Yes, again, this does not seem... irrational to us. This
mm-hmm.
seems rational.
So by my having a stretched view, if you like, a new concept that was not prevalent on earth at the time of my birth, I then, as I developed this view, could then share this view with others, which would also then stretch their view. In other words, it would give them the opportunity to make the same choices that I had made.
Yes, we see in the Gospels that your life held many examples and lessons about
yeah.
the nature of love and how to love and serve.
But also you see in the Gospels that, like in John 17, I was not only encouraging my disciples to just be at one with me, but I said that they would also be at one with the Father, just as I was at one with the Father.
So basically, we see that to be at the time after death. This is
no,
what
but it was said
expected.
Before I died.
No, not your death, our death.
Yeah, but it was said before I died.
So?
And I was speaking about my disciples who were alive. So it does not make any logical sense to believe that it could only happen after a death, after your death.
Now we are beginning to speak about many other... They've got a lot of questions now.
Well, the issue is that the problem is that you're raising many questions that could be more easily answered if I took a different approach with you. What you're doing is you're trying to explain to me your belief systems. As you can imagine, if I am Jesus, I have heard of these belief systems for 2,000 years. And therefore, I understand them very clearly. I understand your concept of God, your concept of the sacrifice, your concept of what this does for you. All of the concepts that you've been explaining to me, I do understand. I've heard them many times before in many conversations I've had with many Christians.
We're sorry, we do not know any other way to ask you about these things.
Well, there is other ways that I can present the truth to you that is much more rapid than this way of discussing your current concepts.
I see. Let's do this then.
The problem with discussing your current concepts is that you are heavily steeped in the belief of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this means that you have to intellectually be convinced of the truth, that another truth exists. And if we are going to constantly engage in an intellectual discussion of conviction before you act, then you may never act, and therefore never get out of the current condition that you're in.
See.
It would be better if I present to you the actual truth, and then you decide whether you would like to experiment with that truth or not. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because you have been experimenting with your truth, and many before you have been experimenting with your truth for 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them find themselves in a very similar condition to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in an even worse condition when they pass.
Mm-hmm.
So this would tend to suggest that the experiment, as it currently is believed by yourself, must be in error some way, because you certainly do not have the things that I promised that you would have, the things that the Jesus in the Bible promised you would have once you passed. So I promised that you would have many mansions, for example. I promised that you would have deep happiness. These are not things that you have currently. So either my promises were false, or your application of my words were false. It can only be one or the other.
Yes, okay, yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Now, I suggest to you that my promises are not false, and I can prove to you they are not false by bringing to you people who have engaged those promises.
I see.
So that's one way I can show you that the promises were not false.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I can suggest to you that if you engage the same way that they have engaged, which I call the narrow way, the way to life, when I was on earth teaching,
yes,
then you will come to understand a different way than what you currently understand.
So how do we engage a different way with our faith? How do we do not know what to do differently?
Well, this is where we can explain this very clearly, what to do differently. There's some very clear things that we can do differently. And this is why I would like to introduce you to some of my friends in the spirit world who lived on earth when I was on earth, people that you've read about in the Bible.
Okay.
And when we introduce you to them, we can then explain to you the way as they had it explained to them from me.
I see.
Does that make sense?
Yes, that's fine.
And their understanding of the way is different to your understanding currently. Because if it was identical, they would be in the same condition you currently are in. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
If a person chooses a certain path and another person chooses exactly the same path, they will surely end up at the same destination.
Yes.
If a person chooses two different paths, then they will end up at two different destinations. And what I'm suggesting to you is that these people that I bring have ended up in the destination of the celestial kingdom, the kingdom of the heavens that I refer to in the first century.
Okay.
And what I'm suggesting to you is that you, while you have not ended up in the hells, you've ended up in other places of the spirit world which are not the kingdom of the heavens that I refer to.
Mm.
And so there are two different destinations. And I referred to the fact that there were two different destinations while I was on earth.
It's seems from our discussion there are many different destinations.
Well, that's why I said in my father's house there are many abodes. And that's even in my father's house. Imagine outside of my father's house how many abodes there are too.
I see.
So in the spirit world, as you've now learned, there are many places that you could go to. Have you investigated some of the places lower than yourself?
Yes, we have.
Yes, so you know that there are places that you can go to that are darker condition than where you
yes.
currently are.
Yes.
It would logically...
We try to help people in those places.
Of course, of course. It would logically be assumed then that there would also be places that are brighter and better condition than your own.
Yes, they're in, but we are at somewhat of a loss as to how to access them.
Of course, and that's what the principle is that we'd like to illustrate to you, is that the people that I can bring to you who are there have accessed them, and so therefore are not at a loss as to how to access them. They will be able to help you access those particular locations.
Sure.
So what if I just ask John and Peter and a few others that you know of from the Bible to come to you? There will be some men and women from the Bible come to you.
Yes, we see them.
Yes. What do you notice about them?
They are not that close to us now.
Mm-hmm.
They seem kind.
Yes. Do they look happy?
Yes. Very.
And when you feel the feelings coming from them, what do you notice? Can you sense the feelings coming from them?
Pleasant. These are good people.
Hmm. Now what I would like them to do is to give you a picture of where they live. They can do this by transmitting these pictures from their mind to yours so that you can see the pictures like a video, like we would see here on Earth.
Yes, this is very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Very beautiful.
More like the places that I promised when you read my words in the Bible, yes?
Yes, but with more beautiful things, yes.
Yep. Now, they can also loan you a bit of power to get to a new location to check out how the next, like not where they live, because they will not be able to loan you enough power to take you where they live. But they will be able to loan you a bit of power so that you can go to a brighter location so that you can even see what is around the corner, so as to speak, in your own development. Would you like to do that?
Sure.
Now, to do it for so many people, we need to have a few more of them come, and they will all envelop you with their power. You will feel that. And the key thing you'll need to do is allow yourself to be emotionally open to this experience. And some of you will find it will trigger some emotion for you, some grief and sadness perhaps, shame for others of you. It will trigger different emotions, and you just need to allow those particular emotions to flow for the experience to occur.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, those of you who would like to do that, if you can go with them for a short period of time and just examine a higher location in the spirit world than where you currently exist.
Yes, this is pleasant and quite confronting.
Mm-hmm. So
there is
it raises a question, doesn't it? It raises a question of why can't you get there by yourself?
Yes.
If such a place exists, there must be a reason why you can't get there.
Yes.
Now, what I'm going to suggest to you is the reason is because you're holding on to belief systems and emotions that bind you to the lower condition. Now, the emotions that bind you to the lower condition is an inability, one of the emotions is an inability to allow yourself to feel grief. That's one of the emotions that bind you to the lower condition. And one of the beliefs that bind you to the lower condition is a fear that God might be a punishing God. That's a belief that binds you to a lower condition, and that's just an example. There are many of such which bind you to your current condition. Does that make sense?
Yes.
These are beliefs and feelings that the people in front of you do not have. And they've learnt to not have them by going through a process.
I see.
And the process is the exact same process that I explained to them in the first century.
I see. Yes, I'm in shock. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of shock, and I do feel quite disturbed.
It's a lot of information to, absorb, but understand that shock is also a part of the soul's growth.
Okay.
So you can relax into that feeling. Allow yourself to contemplate what you've just seen rather than resist it. Does that make sense?
Yes, and this is my endeavour. And there is a young man here, Simon, who is being very helpful to me personally. Mm-hmm.
Can you ask him how old he actually is?
Oh, yes, this is surprising, yes.
How old is he actually?
He's quite old.
So he's not really a young man, he just looks young.
No, yes.
So there must be a reason why he looks young as well, even though he's an old man.
Yes. And has the demeanour of a very young man.
And has the energy and youth and vitality of such a young man.
Yeah.
And it must all be the same reason.
Yes, he says he's willing to assist me, which is kind.
Now, these particular people that I've introduced you to can assist you greatly in learning the way. It's going to be different than what you conceive it to be. And what you're going to need to do for a moment is to remember that one principle that I've just discussed with you. And that is the principle that if you ended up where you currently are, then you must have followed a different direction than the direction that these people who are now in front of you followed. And rather than trying to justify or follow your current direction or try to integrate your current direction into this new direction, it would be more wise perhaps than to listen more openly to the new direction. You will find that there are commonalities and similarities between both directions, but obviously there'll be things that are vastly different. Otherwise you would have not ended up in a vastly different state. That makes logical sense,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes.
So this is what I would suggest to you, that you allow yourself to contemplate that perhaps your understanding of some of the basic fundamental truths as you understood them from the Bible are not the understandings that I actually taught in the first century, but rather were the modification of people who lived after myself, who modified the particular writings to suit themselves and their own understanding.
This is evident now. There must be some problem.
Yes. So rather than being afraid of the problem, the key is to engage the fact of the possibilities it offers you, because it offers you the possibility of being in these new locations that you've seen.
Mm-hmm.
So there is nothing to be afraid of. In fact, there is only joy ahead if you allow the different emotions to flow. The only thing, though, is that whenever truth confronts error, the error has to be felt in order to be released. And that means that you will go through emotional realizations of how the error has affected your life.
I am feeling quite emotional now. I'm crying, mm-hmm. and I do not really understand why. I do not know what is being confronted. But
it doesn't matter. Just allow the emotion to be felt. This is the way that I explained. The way was to allow the emotion to allow God's love to confront whatever untruth exists within the soul and allow the experience of it. Because if you allow the experience of it, it will be released from you.
Okay.
So if you just continue to allow the experience of it, it will be released from you.
Okay.
Now there will be many such emotions that you have, because there are many, obviously, differences in beliefs and differences in feelings that you have compared to these particular people who have come to you. Now, for many of them, they arrived in a similar or even worse condition in the spirit world than you arrived. So they have known what it means to be where you are, and they also know how to get out of the current condition of where you are into their current condition.
I see.
So they have the advantage of personal life experience on this matter.
Okay.
And if you can trust their personal life experience, you will benefit immensely from their assistance.
Okay, they are very kind.
Mm-hmm.
There are many of us who are affected by their level of kindness.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
We thank you. We cannot even now begin to really try to understand the questions that
you're even asking. Yes.
Yes.
So perhaps I can make some suggestions there. As you develop along this path, that they will show you, you know, the pathway to go, you will find that you'll have many answers to your current questions. These will come to you naturally through the process of discovery.
Okay.
All I suggest to you is that you allow that process to occur rather than trying to shut the process down. Does that make sense?
Yes.
If you allow the process to occur, you have the ability to grow infinitely, just as I discovered in the first century. But if you shut the process down through any of your belief systems, then you will stagnate at that particular position until such a time as you reopen yourself.
Okay.
And my suggestion is to never shut yourself down for any reason.
Okay.
That's my suggestion.
We'll do our best. This is certainly quite a change for us, mm-hmm. everything we are discussing.
Yeah. One other thing too is that in the process of this growth, many of your belief systems you will see have been distorted in some way by people in history. So, in other words, many of the belief systems that you've imbibed from the Bible have been a distortion of the original sayings. They contain some truth and some error.
Okay.
So you will see what the truths are quite clearly as you receive God's love. And you will also see what the error is quite clearly as you receive God's love. And if you remain very opinionated or arrogant in your position that you are right, then you won't see new truth and therefore you will not be able to receive more love. So you have the power over your own condition. And that has always been the case.
Okay.
Now, in saying all of these things, the principles and things that you've asked about with regard to my blood saving and so forth, you will also be able to resolve all of these questions. And these people who lived in the first century know what I was actually saying in the first century. That's the advantage of speaking with them.
Yes, this will be wonderful mm-hmm. to be able to ask them.
And they will be able to show you where it got distorted, where the actual original words became distorted through what the Bible taught and how the distortions occurred. They will also be able to show you why you accepted the distortions without question. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because every person in humanity that's ever accepted a religious faith has accepted certain distortions of truth without question. And there must be an emotional reason inside of them why they accept such distortions.
We feel quite overwhelmed at this time.
Mm.
It's very overwhelming and we wish to thank you and we do feel that you have saved us at this moment a great deal.
Hmm.
And
I just want to remind you that you have many beautiful things ahead of you. All of the beautiful things that were promised to you are ahead of you, but not by following the same path that you've followed. You will have to walk the narrow way. And the narrow way is not currently understood by Christianity on earth. And in fact, it's not currently understood by hardly any persons on earth. The narrow way got distorted, along with many of the other things that I said in the first century, over a period of time, particularly over the first 300 years after my death. And these particular people can describe to you the narrow path as I've described it to them.
Okay. Yes.
Now, you may find that through this discovery that many of the questions that you had will almost become mute points. They'll almost become things that you're now no longer concerned about. Mm-hmm. And you don't need to be alarmed at this. This is what happens once you receive God's love and have the reassurance of living in God's love. You don't feel as much worry about what you do and don't know.
Right.
But I am able to explain to you using logic, but so are all of these particular friends able to explain to you using logic why your current belief systems cannot be true.
We are content to speak with these ones. We feel we must leave in order to come to terms with this great experience.
Yeah.
Words can really not express our gratitude. And we feel very humbled to be in your presence.
Look, I have enjoyed your presence and company. I enjoy the presence and company of any person who's seeking the truth, as you know.
Thank you.
So I'm very pleased to have met you.
Thank you.
And I wish all of the 200,000 or so of you the best on listening to the particular people that I've introduced to you, and also following the way, following the narrow path that leads to life.
As we said, we cannot begin to express the depth of our gratitude and the change that this is for us. We know that words are very feeble in this regard, and I am finding it difficult to convey the level of emotion that is now happening for me.
Well, I'd be very happy to have another conversation with you once you feel a bit less emotional. Although I don't guarantee that you'll feel any less emotional at any time in the future.
We thank you. We thank you. And while we have not yet understood how the blood did not save us, we feel that you have saved us this day.
And we can explain through in some other further discussion how the blood cannot save you anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow, they're really emotional now.
Yeah, it's good. Good day.
That was really shut down in the beginning. Just sort of emotionally, and then something happened, and it just all
I feel about sort of having a feeling of resisting God's love quite strongly, and because God's love would have opened them emotionally, and they've just been shutting God's love down. And as soon as the guys came to them and took them on the little journeys, you know, straight away they're opening up to God's love again, and it just like, and as soon as they do that, it become emotional again.
Yeah. Do you think that's why they were so numb to begin with?
Because
they've just been living in a very shut down way.
The problem with having these intellectual conversations with people who are just numbed down like that is that you can go on for hours and hours and hours without any real result, unless, you know, you introduce some other method of helping them learn, you know?
Yeah.
It's good, Dana. It's nice for you, channeling.
Yeah, he came through really strong all of a sudden. I had 4 or 5 other people there who had given me their names, and then right at the last minute was like, Cecil, he's going to do the talking. And he had a lovely feeling about him, really, like quite a gentle kind of feeling. I think it brings up emotions for me just about how much I resist God's love, I think.
Most people have a huge wall up against it, don't they?
I often marvel at our, you know, it feels like the biggest fears are about actually love. The good things, yeah.
Well, it's not really like that. The biggest fears are really about triggering of it, you know, feeling the grief that's associated with feeling the good things.
The good things, exactly.
No, that's usually how it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was lovely to be able to help them.
Yeah.
And isn't it funny how there's all this question about the doctrine and the dogma and all of that, and then they have an experience and it just sort of all goes out the window. And that he was even like, I can't even remember what I was trying to figure out.
Yeah. And well, the significance of the intellectual argument pales in comparison to the experience.
Yeah.
And so the intellectual argument really becomes null and void through the experience. They'll be able to answer the intellectual question in the future, but if you just focus on answering the intellectual question, they don't get to have the experience that will actually help them realise how big the actual truth is in comparison to what they imagined.
Mm. I was just trying to write about this today with relation to the Great Experiment, and this, I just have this feeling about how myself and lots of people I see looking outside of us for inspiration and to grow our faith and to even some people I see they want proof and all these things. And the feeling I was trying to describe is that if we just engage the Great Experiment, then the experience would grow our faith and give us proof and change us.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if we're just still like looking outside for a trigger or inspiration or faith or proof, or we never allow ourselves to have that experience, do we? And
And I just feel like for the majority of people, that's what's still happening. There's such an intellectual analysis of the truth that's presented to them that they don't allow themselves to have the experience. And because they don't allow themselves to have the experience, the truth is never going to be resolved. It's never going to be, it's never going to come to them with as a reality. It's only ever going to be something they have faith in, but never real to them.
Yeah, and that's what came up for me as I was considering this Great Experiment series and really considering undertaking the Great Experiment sincerely every day with my heart. And it just seems to me that when you do, even when you contemplate engaging it, it brings up all your stuff, whatever's in the way, and you're immediately in the midst of an experience rather than just talking about theory.
Exactly. Yeah. And by having the experience, you get rid of the blockages that allow you to understand the truth. And so after the experience, you understand the reality of the truth that you only just before then
understood,
viewed as an intellectual possibility.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. It's beautiful, really, isn't it? Mm. The way God's designed our souls.
And the way he's designed the path.
Mm.
Like, you can't... You can have all of these intellectual understandings and knowings, but in the end it does nothing until you've had the experience.
Mm.
And until you've had the experience, you don't really intellectually understand or know.
Yeah.
You just believe you do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And in that message that we're going to talk about next time with Riddle, he talks about how it's great to, like, seek to understand God and God's laws, but when you really connect to God, then you understand about God's nature. It's not just his love, his power, his wisdom, and that's what you should go for. That's the necessary thing. And
but also, by understanding God's nature, you automatically understand God's laws better anyway.
Because
you feel God's nature, so you know
exactly.
Every time the feeling is out of harmony with the feeling you're feeling from God, that it must be wrong.
Yeah.
So you can easily determine what is truth. It's like, and that, you know, the whole concept that people on earth have is that you can never know what truth is, you know, or that there's thousands of different truths or whatever, disappears once you've experienced God's nature.
God's nature.
Because then you realise, no, part of God's nature is that there is an absolute truth.
Yeah.
That's a part of his nature too. So, you know, and you know, so you understand that completely now, like as a feeling, not as a thought. All understanding becomes feelings.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And also then they motivate you passionately. Like, thoughts don't motivate people passionately. So you can have a thought of love, but it doesn't mean you're going to take a loving action.
No. But that is a widely held Christian belief, isn't it? That love is not an emotion.
Yeah, they all believe, many of them believe love is not an emotion.
And I've spoken to people in New Age circles who've told me love is not emotion.
Oh, yeah,
just
no.
is.
A lot of people, yeah, say love just is. Or they get very philosophical about love.
There's emotions and then there's love.
But once you've experienced love, you know it's an emotion. So a person who is philosophical about love saying that love just is and love's not emotion, all they're telling you really is that they've never experienced love.
Yeah.
Because if they have if they had actually experienced love, they would never say that love is not an emotion. They would understand that truth if they experience. You can only understand the truth once you've experienced. That's why the majority of people still coming along to the seminars don't yet understand, because they've not had the experience yet to understand.
Mm.
Once they have the experience, then they'll understand.
Mm.
But until that point in time, it's only an intellectual faith.
Mm.
It's not even a real faith, because real faith comes from the emotion, like of understanding something from a previous experience.
Mm.
Mm. That's why in the Paget messages they said faith comes from the reception of the love.
Mm. Yeah, and that's true. I feel that's really true.
Mm.
And it grows. You can then build on faith.
But you can only build on faith by having the experiences.
Mm-hmm.
You can't build on faith by intellectually knowing a new thought.
No.
It doesn't create faith. It creates possibility, but not faith.
Not faith. Yeah.
Faith is a knowing of the possibility, which only happens through experience.
Which, it's really, you can't grow a faith without humility. It's the same thing that as teachers, all we can do is open people up to possibility and perhaps spark or inspire some desire. But without humility, people can't actually engage any process and they can't grow faith. And so you can listen and listen, or like for these guys, go to church for years and years and years, and you won't at the end of it have any more faith unless you've engaged your heart.
And you won't have any more true knowledge. You will still be like they are, like they were when we met them. You'll still be postulating about the possibilities because you don't know for certain. And it will still be an intellectual argument about a number of different options rather than knowing for certain what the one truth is.
And you know what struck me about talking to those guys was that it felt to me when he was sort of explaining his state and talking about the rest of them there that they were, no one was in deep distress, but no one had any real joy either.
No.
They were just sort of numb and just sort of ho-hum.
Yeah.
I
wouldn't say they didn't have any deep stress, because when they hear me talking about my blood not saving, that caused them a lot of intellectual distress and fear.
I think it caused them fear.
And so they had some distress. That's why they wanted to talk so insistently.
That's true.
Yeah.
But I suppose what I'm trying to say is like that they
didn't have other strong
that
emotions.
Passing wasn't an extreme experience for them. It was sort of,
they went from one location to another location, which was pretty much identical to the first.
Yeah. Which sort of shows that even if you have a moral life, if your heart's not really engaged and you're sort of carrying deep-seated,
I feel it's because they had a moral life that they ended up into their current condition.
That's what I'm saying.
Their belief systems have restricted them, but their morality and ethical behaviour has allowed them to end up in a similar location to where they
That's what I mean. If you have a moral life, you can pass over to somewhere that's not that bad, but it's certainly not going to be that awesome either.
No.
And that's
and
where
it's interesting even then, the intellectual argument justifying the reason why you've passed in such a condition when you were promised something different.
Yeah. What was their argument? Did they give you one?
No, they just felt that being saved meant being saved from the hells, and they knew they weren't in hell.
Yeah.
So they had been saved, according to them.
Yeah.
And then when I raised to them the possibility of going to the mansions and the other locations, as described in Revelation, they said, no, we haven't been there either. And that's why I raised that with them.
Yeah.
Because, they were, in a way, fooling themselves through their intellectual argument.
Yeah, because they didn't really want to feel their disappointment either. Because I remember he said at the beginning, you know, we're not at the right hand of God or anything.
And none of them had met me. None of them met Jesus as they thought they would once they passed and so forth.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's interesting, hey? It's very... that's what I was going to say. It reminds me of, like, you know, Afra or Fred from Through the Mist. You can see there that he didn't just live a moral life, and we see that in the book, but his life was really engaged. He was engaged with, in his heart, with the suffering of others.
He took actions based on love.
Yeah.
And based on sort of love that was all about giving gifts rather than and not expecting anything in return.
And sort of moral, ethical behaviour that was from a heart place, not an intellectual place. Yeah. And that just shows, you know...
And that's why he arrived in an even better condition.
Yeah.
So he wasn't just a moral person inside of himself. He also took actions based upon love. And actions based upon love have a higher... Mm. Well, they basically have a higher measure. They are a heavier weight, if you like, of possibility, and a heavier weight in terms of how God weighs things up. It's a greater weight towards love than towards moral behaviour.
Yeah.
And moral behaviour has a greater weight than immoral behaviour, of course. But
yeah, of course. That's why they didn't end up in the hell.
Yeah. But even a greater weight would be if we act in harmony with giving the gift of love, then that's even a greater weight than even moral behaviour. And Fred had both, so...
Yeah, so that's
so
why...
So he's going to arrive in a better condition.
Had quite a free life in the spirit world. And he was humble in that he... Not just in the sense that we talk about being able to feel emotions, but he was humble to letting go of ideas. He was humble to...
He was like a child in the way he learned.
Exactly.
He is like even as an adult, he was still like a child in the way he learned. He was still inquisitive, questioning, always asking questions, but also always fascinated.
Yeah.
He hadn't lost any of that.
He's such a beautiful character in that way, I feel.
Yeah.
Just to see what life is like when you don't lose that.
Yeah.
And you foster that. He fostered that. And even in the time from when he passed to, say, to chapter 15 or whatever, but he lets it roll, you know, he keeps developing that,
and he keeps getting confrontation after confrontation of his own belief systems, but he doesn't argue for his own belief systems all the time.
No, he's observant.
He's observant, but also willing to see what happens in actual fact.
Yeah.
And it's easier when you can see what happens in actual fact. So it's a bit like, for example, if you're explaining to a Christian that whenever they're prophesying, they're actually being overcloaked by a Christian spirit.
Yeah.
Most Christians would disagree with you completely, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you explain that to a Christian spirit, they'd know exactly what you're talking about because they've actually experienced it.
Yeah.
And so therefore you're not trying to convince them of something that they believe doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's... The disadvantage here is that people believe what they want to believe, whereas in the spirit world it's more difficult to believe what you want to believe once you've been shown the difference.
Yeah.
You can still believe what you want to believe before you've been shown the difference.
Yeah.
But once you're willing to be shown the difference, like Afra was, then you can't continue to believe what you were currently believing.
Exactly. That's sort of what I meant by observant. He was willing to look around him and test what his feelings were against the evidence in front of him.
And in a way, true humility involves, doesn't it, that process of being willing to observe and be shown something that's different to your current concept.
Yeah, that's what I feel so few people grasp about humility, is that there is a lot in that about your willingness to let go of what you want to happen, want to see as happening, want to believe happen.
Want to believe about yourself.
Believe about yourself concept.
Mm-hmm.
How what you believe the nature of everything is. You have to be willing to confront all of that and be humble to whatever you've shown. And that's, you can't have a relationship with God unless you're willing to say, God knows more than me and I hope to learn from God.
It's good, babe. That was good challenge. That was good. Yeah, they'll do pretty well, I think.
I hope so, hey. It feels really powerful when I feel them shift so much. Yeah.